Welcome to NPR's movie podcast. This week, an ode to MGM's Leo the Lion on his 80th birthday, are computers putting stuntmen and women out of business, immigration is the vehicle for a film about the lives of two unlikely desperate characters, a documentary film about America's obsession with beauty, and a film critic discusses archetypes in the summer's biggest film and a celebrated documentary.
Here is a sound familiar to you from the movies. It's Leo, the famous lion with the MGM logo, and Leo first roared on the screen 80 years ago today. He opened a 1928 film called White Shadows on the South Sea, and the roar was played from a phonograph record. Leo is as much a part of the public image of MGM as its great movies, Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and Dr. Zhivago and Annie Hall. And as a logo, Leo and his roar have been as durable and lasting as any corporate mark that one can think of, or almost anyway. To help us understand why this lion has worked so well for so long, we're joined by Hayes Roth. He's with a firm called Landor in New York, which has been around for a while as well. Since the 1940s, they've been helping companies establish and manage brands. Hayes Roth, welcome to Day to Day. And really, this is quite a simple thing. The King of Beasts turns his head and roars, and you know the movie's starting, you know it's MGM. Why does this work so well?
I think it works for a couple of reasons. One, because of all of the movie logos, it was the first one to have real movement in it. It was a live animal. And I think there's another element that is significant and actually pioneering, and that is sound. It is one of the first sonic brands. And you just played the sound. We all immediately went to our mind's eye. I always go to The Wizard of Oz when I hear and see that logo all by itself. That is a combination of iconic design, an iconic figure, and unmistakable sound.
So some companies now have audio logos like Intel or NBC. They've had this for a while.
Yes. But they don't use the tones quite so much anymore. Intel is the one that everybody thinks of, and then it's hard to come up with a few others. I always think of the it's not really an advertising tone, although they should think about it, but I have a Mac, and anybody who has a Mac knows immediately that chord that plays the minute you turn it on. There are others for software that are becoming popular, and that's really why sonic branding is becoming more important, because thanks to the Internet and all the software programs, we're actually surrounded by more sound, not less.
So sonic brands are growing, sonic ID tags, but they're mostly musical, I think. This is the roar of a lion.
Yes. The roar of a lion is, I think that goes back to something primeval in terms of getting your attention. I think that was, it signifies power and a bit of excitement, and so it was a great concept to begin with, and the fact that it has lasted this long and has been used so consistently, I think, also is a testimony to good branding.
Hayes Roth speaking with us from New York and the offices of the branding firm Landor. Hayes, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And now, a summer action film without special effects would be a bit like a call-in talk show without any calls. This weekend, the next movie in the Mummy series opens, and some scenes look like an expensive video game. And that is the problem, argues Peter Hartlaub, a reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle. In a column earlier this summer, he complained that while computers might one day replace the entire Department of Motor Vehicles, they will never be able to take the place of a guy in a gladiator helmet flying off the back of a moving chariot. Peter Hartlaub is the pop culture critic and a film reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he recently wrote the piece Why Action Films Need Stuntmen and Women. He joins us now by phone from his office in San Francisco. Good to have you with us, Peter.
Oh, thank you for having me, Lynn.
So, Peter, if the technology's there to pull off all these elaborate digital scenes, why do we need stuntmen and women?
Well, I think precisely because the technology isn't there. I think that special effects are a great thing. I mean, I grew up with the Star Wars films and Terminator films and just being so excited with whatever was going to come next. But I think the studios have treated it almost like an arms race for the last maybe 5, 6, 7 years. And each one wants more special effects shots than the next. And you end up with, you know, the end of a film with two computer animated monsters fighting over a green screen background, and you know, we're not ready for that. I mean, it doesn't look real. It doesn't look real like a stunt or someone really doing something and then maybe having it touched up a little bit with special effects.
When did the studio, you know, sort of start to treat special effects, like you say, like an arms race?
I think when a movie's successful with special effects, one recent one that I think did a great job was Spider-Man 2. I thought most of Transformers was really good. I think when a studio sees it done well, they say, I want that and I want more. And I think they put a lot of pressure on a special effects house that, you know, to do things that just can't be done right now. You know, and I compare it to an arms race, but things have escalated to the point where, you know, I actually really appreciate it when someone takes a step back in a movie like The Dark Knight and just focuses so much on stunts and builds real sets and just uses the CGI as little as possible.
What other films can you think of that do exactly what you just described, that is, that give you more of a sense of reality around stunts than...
I think that Indiana Jones, the last one, while there was a lot of CGI in that, as much as possible, they tried to ground it in some kind of reality. There was a lot of really good stunt work on that. I thought that was a great one. I think one little scene movie that I really liked, the movie itself had all kinds of plot holes, but I loved the stunts, was The Descent. And it was in theaters for about 12 minutes, but I loved it. And I think it's going to hold up 30 years from now way better than, say, a Fantastic Four movie.
Now, this doesn't mean you're completely opposed to special effects, because I think in the column you said you actually sort of fell in love with movies in part because of special effects.
Oh, yeah, and completely. I mean, I remember watching just the commercial for Empire Strikes Back and seeing those snow walkers, you know, on that ice planet walking toward the camera. And I mean, I physically didn't know if I'd be able to make it until the day that movie came out. I mean, I thought I might collapse. I was so excited. And I still get excited. I love a good special effects film when they can do things right within their limitations. But too often they don't. I mean, I think probably the best special effects film I've seen in the last 10 years was Master and Commander of the Far Side of the World. And what I love about it is when I say that, people say, well, there weren't any special effects in it. There were a ton, but they were just so seamless, and it played in to help tell the story as opposed to distract from it. And I think it was just a perfect movie in terms of special effects.
What is it, do you think, though, that the real people do bring to the film? Why do they? What kind of energy do they bring that's like that makes you appreciate their contribution so much?
I think stuntmen and stuntwomen, and this applies too to, you know, the people who do the pyrotechnics. I think the ones that I've talked to are so proud of their work and so proud of their traditions, and partly because they're behind the scenes, you know, like the Fall Guy, I'm the unknown stuntman that makes Eastwood look so fine. You know, I think there's just almost an uncommon pride in their work that, yeah, there's some really bad stunts in movies, but there's so many more good ones. And as they've gotten, you know, more and more, I think, marginalized by a lot of these special effects, I've seen better and better stunt work.
We're talking with Peter Hartlob. He's the pop critic for pop culture critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. We're talking about the need for stunt men and women. We're going to take some calls now. Let's go to Ross, and he is calling from Chicago. Hi, Ross.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was actually calling because I'm an independent filmmaker, and I think one of the things that I run into a lot is that it's so much cheaper to do a digital effect as opposed to, you know, actually blowing up a building. And, it, you know, I actually got to work on Batman, the last one, The Dark Knight, here in Chicago. And I actually worked as a stunt PA, and which is, you know, the bottom rung, the bottom feeder of the production cycle. But nonetheless, it was truly, absolutely amazing to see that. And I have obviously seen the film, and it is truly organic. But when you're doing an independent film, it's easier to do, you know, a bullet or a flash or, you know, a blood splatter in a computer as opposed to doing it, you know, with a squib and everything else, because it takes hours of preparation and money and stunts that you don't have. So, I mean...
That's interesting, because I've always thought the special effects were really expensive for some reason, or added
well,
to...
They are and they aren't. I mean, you know, now that the, you know, my computer, I've done bullet hits that look very, very real. And it's just a matter of, you know, if you have the time to commit to it. And obviously, I don't pay myself, so that's, you know, that's a big, you know, side of it. But, you know, if, as long as $260 million budgets are around, then yes, Batman will be made and it's going to be amazing. But is that always going to be the case?
If I can jump in, I agree with you. I mean, some of the best special effects movies that I've seen are not the expensive ones. The Host is an example. It was a Korean film that had a limited special effects budget. It's probably not the kind of independent film that you're talking about, but it was definitely a lot cheaper than the ones in the summer.
Right.
And the special effects I thought were fantastic because they served the story. I mean, they didn't look entirely realistic, but there was no more than it needed to serve the story, and the writing in the story was good, and it had a real emotional impact. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is when they use these computer effects to essentially replace, you know, plot and logic and everything else.
Yeah, to replicate reality, which is, I agree, it's totally not there. And I think the films that are successful are the ones that remove reality from it and try to go for an aesthetic and try to push the aesthetic of the CG or whatever it is. And those usually do really work out well.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Ross.
Thank you.
All right. Great talking to you. Let's go to Vanessa. And Vanessa is calling from Detroit. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I am so excited. First-time caller, long-time listener.
It's good to talk to you. Go ahead.
I totally agree with your guest today talking about, gosh, I'm so excited. I'm flustered. I'm sorry. Talking about special effects. I am a big lover of foreign films. And when you talked about The Host, I just got giddy about watching the visual effects. And I think of actors like Jackie Chan and Jet Li, who are true martial artists, or Tony Jaa, who are true martial artists, but give such a realism to the film that computers can just not replace. Well, I think effects are great for like a Harry Potter movie for a kid flying on a broom, but nothing can replace that man or that person actually doing that stunt that just makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
You are a movie lover, I think.
I sure am.
What do you say to that, Peter Hartlob?
Well, I agree. I think one trend that I'm really happy to see is that I think a lot of directors now who are about my age, you know, in their late 30s and 40s, grew up on a lot of those Hong Kong films on one side, and on the other side, grew up watching Indiana Jones, you know, the first Indiana Jones movie, and Roadhouse, and, you know, these movies. And I think they have positive memories. And if you look at someone like Christopher Nolan with Batman, if you look at Len Wiseman, who made the last Die Hard movie with a lot of stunts, I think a lot of the directors now who grew up appreciating exactly what your guest is talking about want to go back to that. And I'm seeing it more and more with films now. It's like plastic surgery. You know, good plastic surgery. If everybody in the office is discussing whether you got it or not, then you probably did it right.
Right. Okay. We're gonna have
that's
to.
That's how I feel about Gladiator. That's how I feel about most of Lord of the Rings. I think was done pretty well. I can pick out four or five scenes over three movies that I'm was
Peter,
a little disappointed in.
Good talking with you, Peter. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah.
Peter Hartlob is a film reviewer for the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
The market for illegal labor in the United States comes to life in a new film. It's called Frozen River. It's in theaters now. Early this year, Frozen River won the Grand Jury Prize at the Sundance Film Festival, which is where Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan fell in love with it.
As the summer heats up, let Frozen River wash over you. Let its bracing drama and the intensity of its acting restore your spirits as well as your faith in American independent film. Frozen River tells the story of two women who end up unlikely partners smuggling illegal immigrants over the Canadian border. One is a beleaguered wife and mother trying to hold her family together after her husband leaves. The other is a sullen, hostile Mohawk woman.
I'm not going anywhere until those people get out of my trunk.
I'll give you half. Now let's go. Let's go!
I'm not taking them across the border. It's a crime.
There's no border here. This is free trade between nations.
This isn't a nation.
Let's go.
These two individuals don't want to be on the same planet, let alone work together. But circumstance and coincidence bring them together. Their powerhouse confrontations are the heart of the film.
What are you doing with my car?
That? I found it.
You stole it?
Had the keys in it.
So you just took it?
troopers have to say about that?
That's the perennially underutilized Melissa Leo finally getting to carry a film as a deserted wife, and Misty Upham as her angry nemesis. Together, these two actresses create a film that's spare and unsentimental, as well as intensely dramatic.
She stole him from me.
Stole him?
Yeah. Right out of the hospital.
Did you call the cops?
Tribal police don't get involved in stuff like that.
First-time writer-director Courtney Hunt is especially good at creating the hardscrabble world these characters inhabit, an all-too-plausible universe of frustrated expectations and stunted existences. In a world like this, the worst could happen, and nobody would even blink. We come to understand how much these exhausted women, tired of being on the short end of the stick, have in common, though they don't necessarily see it. One of the questions Frozen River asks is how much that kinship will mean in an uncaring, unforgiving real world. It's a powerful question, and the film answers it in a way that will knock you out.
Kenneth Turan reviews films for the LA Times and Morning Edition. You will find scenes from Frozen River, as well as a review of the summer thriller Trans-Siberian by going to our website, npr.org.
Americans spend millions on beauty products, trendy clothes, and plastic surgery. Is America obsessed with beauty? That's a question filmmaker Daryl Roberts explored in his new documentary, America the Beautiful. Model and actress Garen Taylor was at the heart of the film. Now 18, she was only 12 when she started walking the runway. Garen and Daryl joined me to talk about the documentary. I started by asking Daryl about America's obsession with beauty and the power of advertising.
Whether it's an Apple computer, whether it's Skechers with shoes, a lot of industries use sex and beauty to sell their products. So when we talk about beauty and advertising, we're not just talking about the beauty industry. We're talking about a plethora of industries that, you know, use sex and beauty to sell.
What was it that made you want to pursue this film?
Basically, I was on a computer one day and read a story about a guy who had murdered a model, and he said that she was really beautiful. He wanted to date her, and she wouldn't date him, and he said if he couldn't have her, nobody could. So I was sitting there thinking, how stupid, because he went to jail to throw your life away over some beautiful woman. And when I said that, the first thing that popped into my mind was, have I ever done anything really stupid over a beautiful woman? It was a series of questions like that that made me say, wow, this would make a great documentary to see why we're so obsessed with beauty in the first place.
There is the term glamour actually has associations with magic. It's one of those words that comes, Garen, from the idea that beauty can be a kind of magic. Do you feel that way?
People act crazy when they see something in their eyes that's beautiful. They'll go out their way or do anything for that person.
Let me go back to you, Daryl. In the film, you interviewed a girl named Ashley who was 12 at the time. Here's what she told you.
I don't know. I just think I'm ugly.
I mean, but why do you think that?
I don't have a certain reason. I just think it. No one's ever told me, but I'm sure some people think I'm ugly.
She was 12 at the time. Do you think she still feels that way today?
Yeah, actually, I interviewed her when she was 15, 3 years after the clip that you saw, and she still insisted that she was ugly with no concrete proof, which is evidence of how this, I call it toxic beauty culture in our society, are pushing these images on the young girls and telling them, if you don't look like this, you're ugly.
Garen, let's talk about your personal story, which in some ways is the flip side of Ashley's dilemma. At 12, you were discovered on a street in Los Angeles. The next thing you know, you were on the runway and then a guest on the Oprah show. How would you characterize, what kind of person were you before you were discovered?
I believe I've been the same person. I've had my roller coaster throughout my career, but very bubbly, outgoing, just happy. When I was discovered, I didn't really change my persona. I was kind of on top of the world. I never knew the world was so big. And then when in my career, when it just kind of stopped, that's when I developed the eating disorder and just my life kind of crumbled.
I understand that when you were younger, people called you giraffe because you were so much taller, I guess, than the other kids.
Yeah, tall and skinny. And I had a good childhood, but like with my people my age, it wasn't so good.
How did it feel? to one day be giraffe and the next day be completely valued and validated for the same looks that you'd had the day before?
I think that really boosted my self-esteem because my grandma would always tell me, don't worry, Garen, you're going to do something with your height one day and you will be laughing at all these kids all the way to the bank. So when it did finally happen, I was just happy, like Granny was right.
Daryl, what do you think of the way that Garen appeared on the runway, the way that she ended up being made up, and what you have to do to essentially a preteen in order to make them look like a vixen?
I was under the impression, because when I saw her and knew that she was 12, so the first thing I thought was, wow, the fashion industry is sexualizing a child. That was my opinion. And then our culture is becoming very youth-oriented. Now people, when they're 40, 50, and 60, they're trying to dress like young people, listen to their music, get plastic surgery, trying to hang on to this youth.
What about your relationship with your mom and your mom's relationship with modeling agencies?
Actually, she made my life a lot easier because I wasn't, I didn't get caught up in like the pitfalls of like drugs or like sex. She shielded me from a lot of stuff.
Did some of the choices that she made end up undercutting your ability to get jobs?
I'm really not sure because, I mean, there was a lot of inside stuff that was going on with a lot of other people. So I don't really think it was her choice. I think it was kind of like a loyalty thing. When you leave places, they get upset. I don't think she jeopardized anything.
Now, Daryl, your film is not just about Garen, but about how the beauty industry makes money out of people's insecurities. And when it comes to race, there's a whole other level added. And you also feature a man in the film named Dr. Stephen McCord. Tell me about him.
He's a maxillofacial surgeon. He's a beauty scientist, basically. And I found him because he was featured on a one-hour special on BBC. One of his philosophies is that dark-skinned black women, you know, are not beautiful. He made some makeup that would make them five shades lighter. And he said the lighter they become beautiful. But it was an actress from the movie Barbershop. He tried to lighten her skin with the makeup, and she ran out of his house. And this is, you know, all on camera. So he turns to me and said that she's a loser because she doesn't have an open mind. And this all went, like, do a blur. I heard the word welfare. He said she was never a slave. And this guy, like, had a meltdown. To me, what it's symbolic of is the intolerance in our society.
Garen, what about your eating disorders? You mentioned that you had one.
I basically developed it when I got back from London. It was basically just everything that happened in New York, L.A., London, Paris, basically just built up on me.
What do you mean by things that happened? What define that?
Just the stages I went through, just rejection, not getting jobs, hearing that I'm obese. When I was a size 4, by people I've worked with. I booked a J-Lo job and Nanette Lepore, then they called back and canceled on me. Just like a lot of things that weren't going right. I mean, I was put up on a pedestal and I was booking jobs every day, and then all of a sudden it just stopped and I didn't understand why. And then there was a rumor that I was obese and that I was gaining weight. And I was just thinking, like, okay, well, I guess in order for me to get jobs, I need to lose some weight.
Daryl, this project took you 5 years. And you started out with the question, why is America obsessed with beauty? But what do you think is the takeaway from your film?
The message that I'm trying to put out there with the film is that everybody has something about them that's beautiful.
Well, Garen and Daryl, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Garen Taylor is a model and actress. She's one of the subjects of Daryl Roberts' documentary film, which looks at America's obsession with beauty. It's called America the Beautiful, and the New York City premiere of the film is today. They joined us from our studios in New York.
We're two-thirds of the way through the summer now, and 2 weeks into the hoopla over the biggest movie hit of the season. Part two of the updated Batman franchise, The Dark Knight.
You've changed things. Forever. There's no going back.
for a closer look at this high-tech, huge-budget blockbuster. And also at a different kind of film that opens in August, we've invited Dessen Thompson to our studios. Most recently, he was film critic for The Washington Post. Dessen, thanks very much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
You wanted to talk to us about The Dark Knight and also a documentary that's opened, which sounds totally different, but you're going to make the case there's some similar themes.
Yes.
And that's American Teen.
Correct.
What do these two films have in common?
They have in common a sense of archetypes that we live by. Mm-hmm. In the case of The Dark Knight, the archetypes are more heroic and stark and obvious, hero and villain. But in American Teen, these are very real kind of social labels that we've all lived by in high school and recognize: the geek, the outsider, the jock, the cheerleader, that sort of thing. What American Teen does is show very real people who are walking around with these labels. Mm-hmm. And what's fascinating is sort of watching, you know, what the divide between who they really are and that sort of social label they carry around, which I think can resonate for a lot of us.
To fill in that, because American Teen is clearly not the better-known film, but it brought a lot of response at Sundance, I understand. Now, it follows half a dozen students through their senior year of high school in Warsaw, Indiana. Right?
That's correct, yeah.
That's the storyline.
She's probably the biggest drama queen in Warsaw.
Smart, popular, attractive.
All through high school, I've heard, like, she is the biggest bitch.
Maybe I am.
Do you learn in the course of the film that the slogans we hang on each other in high school have some merit, or is there surprise?
What's great about the movie is that it does all of that. It shows just how much those kind of labels define us and also distort us. So we meet someone who is supposedly the geek, and we find out that he's actually a very romantic, relentless pursuer of finding love, and quite at odds with what we think of as a geek who would just sit alone at home feeling sorry for himself, playing computer games.
So do you want to go see a movie? Do you want to do anything anytime soon?
Are you busy tomorrow?
I'm supposed to work tomorrow.
If I have a girl, I don't feel like I'm such a nobody.
I am not going to let anything stop me.
So what we're seeing is that we are one thing, and yet we are not one thing.
Now, is one of the achievements of a documentary like this the fact that if you spend a prolonged period of time yourself, let's say a year, half a year, with a group of high school students, the changes can be so incremental you almost don't notice them. It's like putting your finger in a pot of warming water. But on the other hand, a two-hour, whatever it is, film that condenses it allows you to see the changes in people a little bit more boldly.
That's the magic of the editing room later, is what Nanette Burstein did. That's the director of this film. She followed many characters, many more than are in the film. And she, in the editing, realized whose storylines were really working. So this is a retroactive look, as it were. So obviously over a year you get to see the high points, you get to see the patterns, you see the jungle for the trees. And that's what we see in this movie. It's very illuminating.
Let's talk a bit about Dark Knight. Like everybody else hasn't been talking about Dark Knight, but I know you've got some reflections. Now, is this a film that raises the archetypes of good and evil, but sometimes flags them in the same person?
Yes, precisely. And what's fun about it is watching the good in a villain and the villainy in a hero. That's the fun of most of these comic book type of movies.
I've seen now what I have to become to stop men like him.
In this movie particularly, they have a character played by Aaron Eckhart, who is the public prosecutor, who is portrayed as a completely vanilla hero.
This is Harvey Dent?
Yes.
Okay.
And he, over the course of this movie, through circumstances I won't reveal for those who actually will go to see the movie, becomes an evil person who is bent on revenge. So we watch the process of a hero actually turn into a complete villain, while the Joker and Batman, with their kind of mixture of good and bad, look on. So it's a nice little Molotov cocktail of good and bad.
Mm. So in a peculiar way, the most surprising character is the one who you think is the most normal.
Yes, precisely. And in a way, he is fascinating because he's the one closest to us in the audience. He's the one that's an actual citizen, as opposed to the Joker and the Batman, who are grotesques or extremes of good or bad. So we don't really relate to them. We watch them as cartoons, practically. But this one, you know, he could be us, is what makes it sort of fun to watch.
Film critic Dessen Thompson in our studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.